But you can see that the census estimate for births now, the two dashed lines, there's a medium and a low, and then the estimate for deaths, that's the natural crossover point where we go from natural population growth to natural decline. And it's somewhere out there within 10 years.
Welcome to Thoughtful Money. I'm its founder and your host, Adam Taggart. Narrative drives so much of the thinking today, especially when it comes to the markets. To prevent becoming unduly influenced by it, it's important to ground ourselves in data. We should ask first, what is the data saying? And then we can judge whether the current prevailing narratives are consistent with it. So, what is the current data telling us? To find out, we're fortunate to speak today with Chris Hamilton, publisher of Economica. If you're not familiar with the name, I'm confident you've come across a number of the prodigious amount of charts it publishes across a wide range of macro topics like the economy, demographics, and the housing market. I'll ask Chris to walk us through the charts that have his attention most right now. Chris, thanks so much for joining us.
Adam, great to be here.
Hey, Chris, thanks so much for joining. I know you don't do many interviews. I'm so glad that you've agreed to come on with us today. Huge fan of your charts. And as I said in my intro there, I'm sure most of my viewers here, even if they didn't recognize the name of your company, will recognize your charts when they see them. And folks, you'll see them in just a minute. I like to kind of kick off my discussions here, Chris, with kind of a grounding, sort of intentionally broad question. I'm going to tweak it a bit for you. What macro trends currently have your attention most and why?
Yeah. And thanks so much for having me. I'm clearly going to be driven by demographics. I see everything through the demographic lens, whether it's energy consumption, whether it's finance, whether it's the economy, whether it's housing. I run everything through a filter of demographics, and it explains an awful lot. And so I think a lot of people look at demographics as something that's going to happen in the future versus it is something that is, it's already happened, it's happening, it's driving interest rate policy, it's driving markets, it's driving so much. So it's always the demographic lens that I'm putting things through to understand the foundations of whether it's the Federal Reserve's actions, whether it's the federal government's policies. They are all, in my opinion, and by my data, they're driven by the demographics.
All right. Well, there's that old expression, that demographics is destiny. Sounds like you subscribe to that school of thought. I know that you prepared a bunch of charts for this discussion, and maybe it might just be great to let the charts do the talking. Should we dive into those charts now?
That'd be great. What we're looking at here is employment population ratios or labor force participation by age groups. And what's so important here is that as our demographics have shifted from growth among young to growth among old, it's important to understand what each group, how their labor force participation compares. And so if you look at the top line, we're looking at the 25 to 54 year old segment, 80% plus of them, of that population are employed. You drop down to the 55 to 64 year olds, 64% are employed. And as you keep going down, 15 to 24 year olds, 51. And then here's gonna be sort of an ongoing theme here. The 65 to 74 year old employment population percentage. And then at the very bottom, 75 plus year old. The trouble is gonna be repeating here that all of our population growth is taking place among that 65 to 74 and 75 plus year old segment. They have such low labor force participation, which they should. They get tired. They want to nap. I get it. It's that's not the segment that drives your economy, but that is the segment that's driving population growth, and that is the segment that is not driving potential labor force growth. So that's going to be an ongoing theme here.
All right. And sorry, help me just understand that comment. You say it's driving our population growth. Now, obviously, These are the people who have been around the longest in the population. So we're not adding new 75-plus year olds to the national population. Is it that their percentage of the employment base is creeping up here? Is that what you mean?
So of the population, let's say our population is 336 million. Where the growth is taking place, the net growth in our population is almost entirely 65 plus year olds. So the other portion, the under 65 year old portion, is flat to down. And so all of our net growth is coming among the elderly. So
Okay.
because they're living much longer than previous generations.
All right. So sorry to interrupt, but if I'm understanding you correctly, what you're saying is our population is aging, right? So
Correct.
the percentage of the population that is older is getting bigger. Even if the top line number is staying relatively the same, it's an older 330 million people we'd had
Yeah,
before.
and if we jump to the second chart, I think it'll show exactly sort of this the detail. Oh. So what we're looking at here, again, this is going to show you the entire population split by age groups. Top line is 25 to 54 year olds. Obviously, you can see where the boomers came through. And essentially, there's been little to no population growth among that segment since 2007. That net growth of about 2 million, almost none. Which this is always an issue that people believe that millennials are driving growth. Millennials are simply nudging ever so slightly higher than the boomer population. But on a growth basis, they offer almost no growth. They're essentially just repeating the highs slightly higher. Then you drop down 15 to 24 year olds, and you'll see that that population is essentially the same right now as it was in 1980. No growth, zero. 55 to 64 year olds has been the driver of population growth and employee growth since 2007 and even before, go back to 2000. But now population growth is moving into the bottom two lines there, the 65 to 74 year olds, and particularly now the 75 plus year olds. That is the population segment that is growing rapidly. Because that whole boom, baby boom is entering that segment, and that segment is growing much faster. And if we go to the next chart, we'll see employment among these seg. There we go. So U.S. employees, what we're going to see here is the top line, 25 to 54 year olds, almost unchanged since 2007. In fact, you can even go back to 2000, hardly any change in the top line employment of 25 to 54 year olds. As you drop down, again, you'll see 15 to 24 year olds, very seasonal. That's why the chart zigzags a lot there. But
Yeah.
generally, a slight decline since 2000. All of the growth in employees, particularly, has been the 55 to 64 year olds. And that is the segment that has driven employee growth since the beginning of this century. And now we're getting down into the 75, 65, 65 to 74 and 75 plus year olds. And you see very small growth there in the employee base, where on the previous chart, you saw large growth in their populations. And that's just their labor force participation is, if you look at 75 plus year olds, 8%. So for every 100 new 75 plus year olds, you get 8 employees. Or for the 65 to 74, you get 18. Versus for every 100 new 25 to 54 year old, you get 80 employees if they're maximizing to their potential.
Yeah. So from an economic productivity perspective, always better to have a marginal new 25 to 54 year old than somebody older.
Every day. So that's, and as we get later into the conversation, that's going to be a lot of the conversation about some of the native-born population growth versus the immigrant or the foreign-born, that the native-born U.S. population is very elderly. And so they offer very little employee growth versus foreign-born, which is much younger and more in that high labor force participation zone.
Okay. So, I'm just biting my tongue because there are all sorts of implications of what you're beginning to show here, and perhaps a lot of explanatory power on things that are going right now on right now from a policy standpoint, maybe even particular around immigrations. I'm gonna hold my tongue until you tell me the time is right, because I don't want to interrupt the flow of going through all this great data. But just know I'm ready to, I'm at the ready to have that talk.
Sounds great. All right, we can jump to the next. So I'm going to show this chart. You're looking at the 25 to 54 year old population, which is the light blue columns. The 25 to 54 year old, 25 to 54 year old light blue columns is the employees. The dark blue column, 25 to 54 year old population. The red is marketable debt, and the white is the average federal funds rate per decade. So each of these is the change per decade versus the federal funds rate, which is the average per decade. So what you'll obviously notice here is that federal funds rate lines up very nicely with the 25 to 54 year old growth and deceleration. So as that group came in, they were highly employed. They drove the economy. They drove consumption. And so federal funds rate were rising, slowing the economy. As they were decelerating, interest rates were cut and debt was substituted to create higher growth where the population growth wouldn't have supported it. So this is really important because obviously, it's not showing the full population, but this is the population that drives the drives employment and drives the economy. And going forward, there is minimal growth, de minimis growth here, which is why the last columns in this chart, what you're looking at is 2020 to 2024. You'll see that the debt this decade has already passed the debt incurred over the entire previous decade. And this is, again, this is marketable federal debt. This is the debt that the Treasury sells at Treasury auctions. This is not the Social Security portion. But so in 4 years, we've already surpassed the entire previous decade. And that's by the end of this decade, if this pattern continues, we will double, if not triple, the previous decade's debt growth. And it's a demographic driven function here.
Wow, amazing. And a couple of things. So folks, I'm sorry, I just figured out how to increase the magnification of the chart here. Hopefully this makes it even easier to see now at this resolution. But I just wanna make sure everybody takes away the point that you just made here, Chris, which is for the latter half of the 20th century, the economy really grew due to people power, where we had more and more bodies entering this prime cohort of 25 to 54 year old workers. And that's what drove economic growth. Since the growth of that cohort peaked and is now declining to what you've called de minimis levels, to continue the economic growth that we want, the government then had to rely on debt. And debt, basically is pulling tomorrow's prosperity into today. And you can just see that the debt has been growing and growing and growing every decade. And as you just said here, we're only, barely 4 years into this current decade, and we've already taken on more debt than we had in the previous full decade. Presumably, there's a limit to that at some point. It's a different discussion we can have maybe later on if you want, don't want to interrupt your flow here. But we basically traded people productivity for debt pulling future productivity into today.
Sure, we've made leverage cheaper. We've made debt more easily serviced by making the interest rates so low. But how would we ever pay that debt back is really the question. With ever less growth, with ever more debt, it's a bit of a conundrum.
All right, I think it's maybe one of the seminal conundrums we face. But anyways, continue, my friend.
All right, maybe we can jump to the next chart here, unless you have any. Okay, so obviously here we're looking at the same, by a decade, we're looking at US marketable debt, the growth versus GDP, the growth per decade. And you'll, again, this is just showing where that, what function that marketable debt is serving. Because obviously when we had very little marketable debt growth, we had high GDP growth. That was primarily driven by people, by the high population growth and the high working age population growth. Since that has waned and decelerated, debt has accelerated and GDP growth has decelerated, saying that the debt is not going where we want it to, and it's not serving the function that we would ideally want it to. It seems to be leaking elsewhere. So essentially, I mean, what's happening is that in that switch from people growth to debt growth driven by lower interest rates, the economy is not growing faster. The economy, the economic growth is decelerating as the debt growth is accelerating.
And so maybe another way to restate that is we are already beginning to observe diminishing returns on the debt campaign, where it takes more and more debt to just get the same amount of growth. And in fact, we're even getting less growth going forward right now.
Correct. And obviously the servicing issues start to become a problem as we see with the $1 trillion interest payments now on our debt. And as that is going from a rather smallish portion of the federal budget into a large portion, 30-40%.
Okay. Concerning. I'll just leave it at that.
Sure. Particularly knowing that the marketable federal debt is driven demographically. It is, it's a substitute for the lack of people growth. And so, and that is accelerating, which means that the outstanding debt that we're selling and that we're servicing is going to be growing rapidly.
Okay. Growing rapidly, meaning the future burden is going to be even heavier than today's burden.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that'll be one of the things that we come back to, which is why ZIRP or potentially negative interest rates are more than likely as we move forward. Okay. There's not many other ways to service all of that debt.
All right. And that in itself is, I think, a bold statement to most people. I know in your continuing charts, you'll explain exactly why you think that that might need to happen.
I'll at least try.
All right. Should we go to the next slide?
Yep, please. Okay. So what we're looking at here is labor force participation by age group. So we've talked about this. So the blue columns show by age group their participation. And then the pinkish columns show the population growth through the end of the decade. So what you should notice here is, again, that discussion of growth among 65 to 74 and 75 plus year olds. Those are the columns that are exploding. The trouble is, again, they have very low participation levels, 19 and 8. So when we jump to the next chart over here, we're gonna see just by doing some simple math and we look at their potential, it is, let's see if we can jump to that next chart. So when we take that population growth by age group and we just multiply it by their labor force participation, and this is the potential employee growth. There's always, you know, a chance. Japan has essentially gotten by raising their labor force participation, and it's gotten very high. I mean, 90%. I mean, they are so high. We've been very steady in our labor force participation. We haven't seen any kind of jumps along the way. So if we just take those existing labor force participation percentages by this population growth, this is the potential employee growth over the remainder of the decade. It essentially works out to about 500,000 annually of potential employee growth, which is way below trend. And that's going to, obviously, we'll have to come back to this as we get into immigration. And if we can overcome these really bad demographics, with high immigration. But this is how it works out by the census numbers, by the BLS labor force participation, to extend it through the end of the decade, and you have hardly any employee growth, potential growth. That's if all goes well.
Okay, so big declarative statement. If the status quo remains the same, we're basically running out of so many workers that we're not likely to have any economic growth. We're not likely to really grow our employee base.
Correct.
Much.
And
of course that then raises the question: well, if you can't grow your employee base, and you know your economy is a function of number of employees being productive, how can you grow your economy if your employee base isn't growing?
Correct. It's a bit of a conundrum again of, you know, that 8.5 million growth in 75 plus year olds works out to about 700,000 employees. It's very, obviously very minimal.
Right. And, you know, employees that can't work for very long, right?
Yeah. You question even that 700,000, you know, how that's not what drives your economy. That's not what drives manufacturing or most other segments.
Right. There's obviously a lot of jobs you can't do when you're that old, right?
Correct.
You can't work on a construction site in most cases, that type of stuff.
I hope so. So, and this is, we're going to jump into a little bit of looking at the census numbers. We're looking at the under 60 year old. This is the most recent census data from 2023. Their prognostication through 2050. And this is year over year change of under 60 year olds in the blue columns, 60 plus year olds in the orange columns. This is the baseline. So, when you look at that, you realize, okay, we've obviously not got much growth, or we're negative right now. The census is hoping that we will have a bit of growth mid-century and then start slowing again as we get towards 2050. What's interesting, so this is the baseline. And clearly, I think right now, given the high immigration, if we have a million immigrants coming in annually, that changes these numbers. And that's, so we'll look at the next chart, you're gonna see a census high and a census low immigration. This is the low immigration projection. Obviously, it's pretty bleak with the under 60 year old population declining fairly rapidly. And this is all driven by the declining births, by higher deaths, and it was driven a bit by lower immigration. Now, obviously, that has turned. And the sustainability of that higher immigration, that's a whole other political discussion. But as we look at the next chart, this is the high immigration census. So this is maybe more of what we're looking at, where you have a high number of foreign-born coming in and helping to offset some of the native-born population decline. So that's really the realm of possible. And obviously, when we talk about immigration and what's happening at the border, and you know, it would be a nice thing if it was driven by policy rather than just driven by chaos. But there is reason for higher immigration numbers. Now, whether they're going to, the way we're doing it is really a big question of, will it help the economy? Will those immigrants join the labor market, or where exactly will they go, and how integrated will they become to the economy?
Right. Okay. And let's take just a quick beat here. So you basically laid out that demographically, we are in danger of hitting like a stasis point on our economic population if we just continue status quo. So if we want the U.S. economy to continue to grow, you can make a pretty good argument that immigration can be a big part of addressing that. and the high immigration projections we're looking at here, this is a much more favorable chart than the previous couple ones that you just showed, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So you could say, oh, well, maybe that is what's driving the current administration's, seemingly obvious intent to get more immigrants coming into the country, right? You can disagree with the methods, but you can sort of see a logic of, oh, okay, we get more immigrants coming in, and we start addressing that demographic hole that we seem to be falling into, right? So to me, this, says, okay, great. We should have a adult-sized discussion about, is immigration a key part of the solution? And if it is, great. What do we think is a good policy? And what do we think are the right, rules and regulations to drive that policy, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I would lament the fact that we're not kind of approaching it that way. It sounds like from some of your comments that you might see the same. But if you're one of those people who just sort of immediately says, immigration or more immigrants equals bad, and you can make, a case that I've made before, which is we have a lot of untapped human potential in this country already that we're not making the best use of, right? We have, I think, over 100 million people who are not included in the labor force. And yes, some of them are too old or some of them are in college, but there are millions and millions and millions there that are able-bodied, folks, many of whom are in that 25 to 54 range that you talk about. But for one reason or another, they have checked out or are just not looking for work anymore. And so, you could make the argument, well, let's get those people, to productive work first before we start bringing a whole bunch of, people we don't know, much about across the border. Look, I'm sure it's more nuanced than this, but my point is if you sort of hear more immigration and have a knee jerk, well, that's bad because we have to solve these other problems first. Maybe it is more nuanced than that. Maybe there really is a good role here and a needed role that immigration is going to play to keep our economy growing the way that we need it to. We just need to be having more like open discussions about the pros and cons and the strategies and the tactics that we're going to use to do this. We're sadly not. Maybe that's something all of us can agitate a bit more for from our elected officials going forward.
Yeah, and whether it's Canada with just nearly insane immigration policies, Finland, I mean, nation after nation, when they have very low birth rates, are choosing to immigrate their way to a higher population. And there's a lot of questions there. If your birth rate is collapsing and your native population is suffering under the financial and Federal Reserve driven policies, then is it really the right approach to try and use immigration to substitute for the lack of growth by your own population? And what's happening to that population? So that's a different question, but it is an important question of, I mean, this year we had as many births in the US as we had in 1950, sorry, 2023, same number of births we had in 1950. So the births have collapsed.
And how much bigger is the population now versus 1950? I want to say
Oh,
a lot, right? I mean,
yeah.
More than
And I
double.
mean, it's easy double. And I should have written that down. But yeah, essentially, what hasn't grown as much? Well, I would say the childbearing population has doubled. The total population has maybe tripled. But the childbearing population is beginning its turn down. And so what you have is essentially these different demographic paths are of the elderly growing rapidly and of the childbearing and younger population now moving into reverse. And that's their future, their capability to be part of this economy is really a big question. Are they getting left behind?
Well, I think if you talk to most millennials who are now at the household formation stage, a lot of them are saying, yeah, we are. It's really hard. And you're seeing a lot of them choose not to have kids or certainly to choose to have fewer kids than before. And of course, this again gets back to policy, right? Which is where we are, like it or not, in the trajectory, the wealth is really kind of over concentrating in the bank accounts of those older Americans that we have here, right? Younger
Correct.
Americans don't have the capital and the affordability of getting into a home and, you know, the basics of capital formation are a lot more unaffordable today than they were to previous generations, right? So it's harder. And so this is just a natural, you know, formulaic outcome of the current conditions, is that people are just saying, well, I'm just not going to, you know, have kids or I'm going to have fewer or whatnot, right? So, you know, from a policy standpoint, we should ask ourselves, well, gosh, are there things that we can be doing to support family creation, a higher birth rate, you know, incent families, and honestly, you know, things like the child tax credits and stuff like that were, you know, initially kind of put in place, that the you know, some of the benefits of getting married, you know, were put in place to make it easier for families to get started. Clearly they're not doing enough now, but are there changes we could make to make that happen? And that obviously should be a big piece of the puzzle, which is, hey, but before we turn to immigration, what can we do to juice up our birth rates for the folks that we have here? That gets us maybe to some distance towards the finish line. Maybe immigration needs to get us there, you know, the rest of the way. And of course, that then opens up the question, and I think you alluded to this earlier, well, what type of people do we want to bring in, right? You know, right. Do we want to bring in anybody? Or what happens if we bring in a bunch of people at the lowest end of the socioeconomic spectrum who start competing with, you know, those younger generations for the same resources and jobs and social support and whatnot? And we actually make the problem, you know, some of these problems even worse for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, and it feels like immigration, discussing immigration is like a third rail, that it just politically, it seems that we can't have an open debate and discussion. And as you say, as grownups decide, who should we bring in? How many should we bring in? Instead, it's just de facto borders open and whoever comes in, comes in.
Right. And if you put any sort of selection criteria, it immediately equals racism.
There's that.
Yeah, which is hard. And it's hard for two white guys, you know, like us to comment on this publicly. And again, folks, you know, I'm not doing this to push any particular agenda. I'm just trying to highlight what Chris's data says here, which is, look, if we don't address this, we are kind of entering the, I don't want to be too hyperbolic about it, but the death spiral, the doom loop that countries have fallen in ahead of us, like Japan and Italy and whatnot. And if we want to try to find a way to pull out of that descent, we have to come up with solutions to this issue. And it looks like immigration is going to be a potentially big part of that. So we should be able to have a constructive dialogue about it where we can determine what serves our interests and what doesn't, rather than, as you said, I think the strategy right now is just chaos. And that's the classic, you know, failing to plan is to plan to fail.
There you go. All right, let's jump onto the next chart here and see. So this is just a quick explanation of where we're at. Red line here is your federal debt. So $34 trillion. Blue line is your GDP. And Federal Reserve balance sheet is yellow, and federal funds rate is the white dash. So what you'll notice, obviously, is since 2008, GDP has grown relatively slower to growth in federal debt. So much so that essentially almost a 2-to-1 growth since 2008, federal debt over GDP. It's pretty astounding. And so when you look at how we've and where that money has gone, obviously assets have been driven by low interest rates and high creation of currency. That currency, once created, is hard to control where it goes, but it primarily goes into assets. And so those asset holders have been rewarded with, so elderly and institutions primarily, those are the groups that hold the assets. They've done very well. Those that are potential home buyers, those that have little assets, those who are just working, have seen high inflation, high growth of their costs, but have not had the shield of owning assets to outrun the growth of that inflation. Any thoughts on?
No, you said it all well. I mean, it's we are like I said, we're borrowing from tomorrow, right? I mean, as a nation, right? You said here, you showed how we're growing the debt way faster than we are the national income. That strategy, our policy strategy that we've used to kind of create that environment, it's what's been driving this wealth gap that we referenced earlier, right? And it's just, again, it's just sort of another one of these. The status quo is just unsustainable, right?
Correct.
You're crushing the prospects of your younger generations with this strategy. And of course, at the end of the day, a strategy like this doesn't work for anybody, because once the debts get to the point where they become so unserviceable, you have to sacrifice the purchasing power of the currency to keep the debt supported, and then everybody loses.
Correct. We can jump out of the next one here. So this is just it's a little busy, but essentially the blue columns, year over year change in 25 to 54 year old population. The red line is US quarterly GDP growth minus US quarterly federal debt growth. So how much of a factor is that playing? And then obviously the white line is federal funds rate policy, or sorry, federal funds rate interest rate. And so you see that where we have high population growth among the working age population, we have generally positive GDP growth ahead of federal debt growth up through 2000. After 2000, you start to see obviously that the population growth is decelerating and goes negative and is bouncing now, or essentially bouncing up and down with very little growth. And obviously that coincides with ZERP, zero interest rate policy, to allow high debt issuance, but it achieves little GDP growth. So you can see how these are interrelated.
Yeah, so I find it really interesting, and maybe it is just coincidental, but that the year-over-year change in that key populace, 25 to 54-year-old cohort, flipped negative for the first time right around the Great Financial Crisis.
Yeah,
And
exactly.
I know there are lots of other things that created the financial crisis, a lot of excesses in the mortgage lending market and all that stuff. But do you see a connection there more than just coincidence?
Yeah, I mean, for me, the Great Financial Crisis was the end of demographic dividend. So we had this growing population, and then it was decelerating. And so as we had fewer and fewer potential buyers, home buyers, we lowered standards to continue to sell more and more homes. But it was the decelerating growth, and then the actual decline of potential buyers, and then obviously employment followed this. Employment is much more drastic. And so as you had those two factors come together, it drove mortgage industry, it drove interest rate policy to trying to pull in every last potential person into the housing market. And that was a demographic factor driving the GFC for me. And that was, and I think unfortunately, people talk about the unscrupulous, the ninja loans and so many other things. But I think those were a reaction to the demographics that were playing out.
Okay. And as we look forward here, so again, this chart just sort of underscores the importance of having growth in this key working age population post GFC here. It's much more anemic. It's gone negative, it pops back up positive, it drops negative again. I'm trying to remember the chart you showed earlier, but obviously you think it's going to remain this anemic and then potentially get to a point where it starts just going negative from there on, as the baby boomer, sorry, as the millennials begin to age out of this, in 10 years' time, your eldest millennials will probably start becoming 55, right?
Yeah, so I mean, essentially, what's already happened—the bottom demographically has already fallen out a bit from the native-born population. The births have been declining since 2007. They're now down over 1 million a year from what census was anticipating. We've had almost 10 million fewer births than the census was anticipating from 2008 till now. So the whole generation, I mean, that's like a World War One sort of loss of an entire generation.
Yeah.
And they are, and that will be, and that's now coming into the working age population, that much smaller native born population since 2007. Every year it gets smaller, and it replaces a larger outgoing group. So that's, we've begun a demographic decline, and that is going to be hitting the working age population. If you look at colleges, it's already hitting the colleges, where the native born population is shrinking rapidly. And again, the hard part is that this is, it's very regional. So some regions have large declines. Other regions have stayed flat. So much like when you look at Europe, you have a high growth areas, you have low growth areas, and that's the U.S. South is obviously the high growth area, Texas, Florida, some others, North Carolina. And then you have very low growth, negative, well, not, shouldn't say growth, high declines. California, New Mexico, New York, Illinois, Michigan, on and on. There's a long list of states that have had collapses in their population from the bottom up. And it's just being masked by the growth of the elderly right now. So this is hard because the U.S. is such a large composite. And so, you know, we're talking about things here that people in the South are shaking their heads and saying, what are you talking about? Right. There's lots of growth.
Everybody's moving to Nashville. Everybody's coming to Miami. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you did a good job of reminding me that the numbers here, they're not just the native borns in this cohort. It's also including immigration too. Yeah. So some of these more recent spikes, you know, maybe being helped by immigration, not.
I think so.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Okay, great. So yeah. So key thing about this chart, main inflection point happened right around 2008. Now we're kind of just barely keeping our head above water, if that, and your calculations going forward expect this to only get worse.
Sure.
Short of some sort of massive immigration wave.
Correct. I mean, that's a potential, and how that is integrated into the economy, that's a whole other question of you know, how well linguistically, culturally, you know, skills match, all that kind of stuff. You know, their education levels, is that going to fill the jobs that we need filled?
Okay. And you know, I want to reiterate why I brought you on here, Chris, because you're doing a phenomenal job of validating it, which is human nature being what it is. You know, when times get a little bit uncertain, we all just wish that, hey, you know, can somebody just fix this? And we just go back to the way it was. Right. And, you know, we've had this, everyone's been hoping for the Fed pivot now for the past, you know, year and a half or so. And the Fed has basically now said, yeah, OK, we're pretty much done hiking. We're going to do, we think, at least 3 rate cuts this year. And the market's reacting accordingly. And everyone's kind of like, oh, phew, you know, we've made it through the chaos of the post-COVID era. Right.
Sure.
And now things are going to get back to the way they were before. Right. Where it just life becomes easy again and stocks always go up and, you know, whatever. And we enjoy whatever economic growth and inflation stays low. And, you know, what your charts are saying here is on some really important key issues. We have crossed a Rubicon. You know, we're in a different world. There is no going back to the way things were before. And this chart's a good example with a much broader scope. You know, we're just not going to see the growth in the economy that we enjoyed for much of the past 50 years going forward, unless we do something about this working population cohort, which simple math just tells us is now going into decline. And we're going to just have a much harder time to growing our economic pie. And that means there's just less for us to go around, less per capita to go around, as long as the per capita stays around the same. And it's going to be a very different future unless we tackle this head on. But,
sure.
You know, to our earlier point, there's not a lot of open discussions about how we're going to tackle some of these really big things.
Yeah, and Japan is always kind of the canary in the coal mine. And so if you look at Tokyo is still growing. It's the largest city in the world, continues to grow. The rest of Japan is shrinking. And so when you see the Japanese numbers, the bulk of Japan is actually depopulating much faster than the numbers that we see. They're just sort of masked by Tokyo, which continues to grow. And so, and very similarly in the US, the South is growing. Five, six states that are really driving that. And that's a whole different, it's almost like a different nation right now. They are going a different direction. You can say that's political, you can say that's economic, you can say it's demographic, but they're different versus the Midwest, the Northeast, much of the West, California, that are rapidly heading into depopulation. And so we have these different, and but yet they're all under the same interest rate policy, which creates some massive bubbles in some places, keeps other places from major deflation. But so it's one umbrella over a lot of very varied demographics, economics, and that makes it very difficult to manage them.
Right. And to your point here, the fate of a state, can buck the fate of the nation here, at least for some period of time, depending upon whether it's a beneficiary of those flows or not. But, in the long run, nobody escapes what you're talking about here.
Correct. I mean, these are national numbers. Everybody will have a different view from where they're sitting.
Right. But to your point, like about Japan, hey, every Japanese person could end up moving to Tokyo, but if everybody in Tokyo is 80 years and older, that doesn't make Tokyo a thriving powerhouse.
No, in fact, the more people move there, the lower the fertility rate goes. It's a really a difficult situation that the more it grows, the faster Japan shrinks.
Okay. All right. Well, what more you got for us, buddy? This is already a
So
lot to
let's jump
digest.
on. So I think this is interesting. So the blue line is employee population ratio. Peaked in 2000. So again, this is looking at the red columns this time is that same GDP minus federal debt growth. So the growth versus growth. What you're going to note here, obviously, from my little arrows, is that in 2000, the demographically driven peak in employment population ratio at 64.5%. Since then, the part of our population that's working is declining. And then you'll see each peak, the 63.4% in 2007, that's as high as it was able to get. By 2019, it could get to only 61%. This time around, we peaked, we're coming back down again. Each time it peaks, that is the start of the next recession and the start of the next growth of debt spending, in particularly in advance of GDP growth. So we've begun the next cycle down each time to maintain the appearance of growth.
Okay, and I know that you are a chartist and a data hound more than you are sort of an economic forecaster, but you just said whenever we have a peak in this population ratio, it's then followed by recession. Does your best understanding of the data suggest that we are likely to have something more heavy than a soft landing ahead of us here?
I mean, we're kind of off the map as far as what policymakers will do and how far they'll go. And so it's hard to really know, if they have the tools to avoid a hard landing versus a soft landing. The assumption each recession has been progressively deeper and much worse. There's no reason not to expect that we wouldn't continue to have the same larger declines, which are then offset by larger debt increases, and that's obviously creates all kinds of problems for the sustainability of that model.
Yeah, and the more debt you have, right, the more of your income has to go to servicing that debt. And as we've seen over the past year, as interest rates have had to go a lot higher to try to contain inflation, the amount of national income that's going to service the federal debt has exploded, right? It's now
Correct.
over $1 trillion annually, right?
Yep.
And so if each time we tip into recession, the response is, debt spending, debt funded stimulus. And likely ever more debt-funded stimulus. As you said, we were seeing diminishing returns on debt
Correct.
spending. Kind of the cure is making this the situation even worse in the long run, right?
Correct. Yeah. So if we jump onto the next chart here, this is the number of families, million families with children. The blue line that you're looking at there, the top line, rising until 2007. And since 2007, the number of families in the US with children has declined by 4 million. Unprecedented, nothing like this has ever happened in the US, where you've seen families with children turn and on a dime turn and go down. So what we're looking at here in the red line is the Case-Shiller Home Price Index, and the yellow line is the Wilshire 5000. So as the interest rate policy was taken to zero, again, this is the asset prices explode of the institutions and the elderly primarily, and the impact on young adults, on families is essentially they have to make a choice. And the choice has been fewer or no children in a rapid turn that has turned the demographic map of the US.
Okay, so you're basically saying that young families had to make a decision, or sorry, young couples had to make a decision, basically shelter or progeny, right?
Yeah,
Like,
sure.
yeah. And I'm curious, and of course, shelter is a representation of kind of all the essentials of life, right? Everything's getting more expensive, more relatively unaffordable than it had been for the previous generations.
Correct.
I totally get that. I think the data bears it out here. I'm just curious, is there also like a psychological scar from 2008 for this cohort? Because many of them, it was the first time they had seen a recession in their late childhood or early adult world. They saw a lot of their parents lose money and struggle. And so could it have made them just more conservative? Because they were scarred by that. I'm postulating here. I don't know, but I'd be curious to hear your thoughts.
I mean, I think the children who went through the Great Depression were shaped by that experience, and there was that generation was much more conservative. They were less likely to put money in banks. So yeah, that's very, very possible.
Very possible. And here's another armchair psychiatrist guess. We also have sort of seen this rise of social media starting around that time, which very much is sort of, YOLO and, let me show how much better I'm doing than everybody else. And so it's all about me. It's not about
Yes.
starting a family, right?
Yes.
So do we just become also maybe, a bit more financially reckless, perhaps? It's an argument for the other side of the scale. So I don't
And
know.
I do think that the zero interest rate created all sorts of risk taking and gambling, and it changed the economy fundamentally. Having free money.
Totally agree. I feel like I should do an entire interview just on that, just on the social legacy of risk-free credit. Because yeah, it led to a ton of malinvestment. I mean, certainly asset price-wise, but I also wonder just in terms of human behavior, do we get a lot of malinvestment that it was engendered by it?
Yeah, and this is a bit of I'll get off track here just for a moment. But essentially, the way that money is created is the young adults. It's not f the Federal Reserve. The government doesn't really create money. The money is created in the banks by taking debt. And so what happened is that when you see that previous chart where the working age population stopped growing, sorry, one more back. But what you see there is that the group that takes out all the debt, the group that grows the money supply, essentially stopped growing. And the group that is credit averse, that pays off their debt, doesn't want new credit, the elderly, started growing very fast. And so money creation via banks became a problem. And that's exactly when you see the federal government step in with their Federal Reserve balance sheet exploding with all other sorts of programs to artificially create the money that demographically the lack of growth of young, that it created a problem that how, I mean, just like in Japan, without the growth of that young population, you can't grow your money supply if they're not growing their debt, at least as a group. And so anyway, it's a demographic issue of the money creation. And we're now deep into that where as fast as the government creates money, money is also dying on the other side. God, with the growth of the elderly, because they're deleveraging so fast.
It's a great lens to look at it through. And they're deleveraging so fast. And then, of course, as we get further along this timeline and the baby boomers stop hitting retirement age 10,000 a day and they start hitting their death at 10,000 a day, you get a lot of forced selling. You get a lot of that's very deflationary, right?
Correct. So everything the Fed is doing is they're in a fight with deflation, and the deflation is accelerating. And so the Fed is accelerating their tools to try and avoid that deflation.
So a fellow that would just love your charts, if he's not already aware of them, is Lacey Hunt. In fact, I'm making a note here as we're talking to send Lacey this section of the video here. Because this is basically Lacey's central point, and he explains this through a lot of his own charts that have to do with money supply and monetary policy and the standard sort of economic supply demand charts. You're doing it largely from a demographic standpoint. I think the two would marry together really, really well. And it's interesting. So I just want to get back to something I said earlier. You have, we'll call healthy national economic growth by a rising tide of this working age population that's able to invest for the future, take on productive debt, right, to
sure,
have homes and build factories and all that stuff, right? Once that starts going into reverse, that's when you get into trouble. The way in which we've dealt with that so far is we've had the Fed step in and basically make up the difference, right? But you get to the point where the Fed and the fiscal side of things work together to do this. So they're kind of the backstop, right? But that only works for a certain period of time, right? And then there's no sure. other backstop to go to. And so I think what happens then, I said earlier, it's usually the purchasing power of the currency that gets killed. Now, it doesn't have to be, right? It could be, you could solve it by debt defaults, right? You could let sure. that mountain of debt that can't be serviced anymore default, which would be, look, I'm not sugarcoating it, wickedly painful. It would be horrific.
Yeah.
And probably completely politically untenable.
Because
anybody to actively choose it. But we could do it, or it could get out of our hands. We've had the Great Depression. We've had periods of time where deflation just grabbed the wheel and took off with it. But if not, what generally tends to happen is the governments just turn the printing presses up to infinity, and they kill the currency. It seems like you're pretty confident that deflation is really the monster we should be more worried about in the long term. Do you have a point of view as to which way this would end if we can't find some way to salvage the system in either default or currency destruction?
I mean, what we're looking at, I think, in this cycle will be an explosion of debt that is beyond what really the system can handle any further. So the U.S. will, I think within this decade, like I said, more than another eight, 9, 10 trillion of marketable debt they're going to be putting out, and that is the only means to finance that is a zero interest rate policy, and that's going to create obviously that only makes the spiral worse from a birth perspective, from a cost of living perspective, from all of these other side effects of that money creation. So the fix worsens the problem. It doesn't fix it.
It doesn't fix it. And if we go to a ZERP policy, I mean, who knows what's the environment's going to be like going forward. But right now, we're hearing a lot about how foreigners don't really want to buy our treasuries the way that they used to in the past. And this is with treasuries offering a lot richer yields than they did before. So if we issue this explosion of new debt and it's got, basically no yield on it, who's going to want to buy that?
The Bank of Japan is the again, watching what how they've managed their situation. They are the bond market, they are the stock market, they are the housing market. Their QE, amid ongoing housing creation, depopulation, their housing market is appreciating, and that is entirely due to the Bank of Japan's purchasing of everything. They are underwriting the entire Japanese financial system by being the buyer of last resort of everything. And I think, unfortunately, that is Japan has been the path that we're all sort of following.
All right. I mean, it sounds like you're saying Japan is a preview of coming attractions. You want to see what the US looks like in a decade or two, just look to Japan.
Unfortunately, that's what we're that seems to be tracking.
Okay. All right. I keep holding you up here. I know you got some more charts to get through.
Sure,
We're already
jump
at the
on.
hour mark, but this is super useful. So let's keep plowing through.
Okay, you can edit all of this down, hopefully.
No, it's okay. The audience, they always tell me they want more. So, like it
Okay.
or not, folks, we're gonna keep soldiering on here.
All right, so we'll go through some of these quickly, but this is U.S. families with children under 18 years old. 2007, you see a peak. That was a peak long in coming, and it's been rising from beginning of the nation. The red line is U.S. housing units, total housing units. So there's a lot of discussion about a housing shortage, and I have an opinion on that. But essentially, you can see that housing units have continued to grow rapidly, whereas families with children are in rapid decline.
And
And so,
this just
oh, go ahead.
kills me. Sorry, I got to editorialize for a second here, because we've been talking a lot about sort of the plight of the younger generations here, right? And now they're having fewer kids, right? Fewer families with children. We have substantially more housing stock
Correct.
than we did 20 years ago, and yet somehow we can't put these families into houses. We
Yeah,
keep
and we
hearing that
definitely
there's this.
we have an affordability crisis. That is no doubt. They are unaffordable, and we have a distribution crisis, seems as well, of certain people owning multiple, second, third homes. It's those who have the means and the assets are buying up and taking advantage of the situation. Those without the assets haven't got the any chance to get into the game, and they're becoming I hate to use this word, but serfs. They will be rent paying serfs for the rest of their life.
And this is another example of one of those adult side discussions we need to have, where we have to say, look, is this serving our national long-term interests or not? Right. I find it hard that many people would say it is serving our interests, right? So a very important pushback is free markets, capitalism, right? The market should determine who gets what, right? But there are points in time where you have to say, look, if it's sabotaging the majority's long-term interests, perhaps we need to have some regulation around this, or some incentives, some ways that try to build the future that we want to have.
Sure. We've set up the rules for the game that reward investors over first-time home buyers, that reward and there's a lot of zoning issues. There's issues at sort of every level, from the federal government down to the counties and the cities and the states. And so all of them have a part to play in this, of making trying to help young people get into homes versus making homes solely an investment. They should be shelter, and the policies should be favoring shelter over people trying to make money off of these
Right,
homes
make a
rather than
return. And we haven't even talked about, the increasing percentage of institutional capital that's getting into the single family home market and whatnot. And look, I don't expect you to have the solutions for this stuff, Chris. Your job is just to show what is happening, what the data is telling us here. But I'll beat the drum here, which is, we really do. I mean, you and I could come up with a massive laundry list of tangled challenges like this, right? Where everybody admits it's a problem. But man, you try to implement a solution, and there's all these different, issues from national reasons to local reasons to,
And the heart of it is in
X, Y, or
California.
Z, right? Yeah. And I live in California, where it's like, geez, they tried to put a public toilet in San Francisco, and it was going to cost, like, I don't know, $2 million to do that. And some guy said, look, I will donate like the toilet and everything. And it still ended up costing over $1 million just because of all the permitting and all the red tape and everything had to go through there. And you're like, look, when we're at that stage, we just got to step back and say, yes, we've accreted all of these rules, probably for good reasons when each individual rule was passed, but collectively it's now become a massive deterrent. And why don't we just, step back, maybe take a chainsaw to this thing, at least on a whiteboard, and see, can we come up with a smarter, better way to do this that serves our interests better? But this is a
Absolutely,
key
and
one.
at every level.
You,
So we
we,
can
we,
jump on to the next one here and just.
yeah, yeah. I just want to underscore, and I know I'm beating the horse
Oh, go ahead.
dead, but when you're forcing couples to choose a roof over children, that is not a recipe for a prosperous nation over time.
It makes you question what we're doing, whether it's, South Korea is essentially, they are an endangered species. If they were an animal, they would be on the endangered species list. And many other nations are, their policies are destroying themselves.
Yeah. Well, and that's
And you
what's
have to.
killing me is if we were falling into this trap, never having seen this situation before, I wouldn't like it, but I could understand a little bit better. But you're saying, look, there are plenty of countries we can look at. We know how this playbook ends. Like, let's not just sleepwalk into it, right?
And again, this is just looking at births. So annual births are the blue columns. Federal funds rate in black. The white line is GDP, and red line is federal debt. It just kind of go straight up to 2007. You see that we had a that was our all-time peak in births, and we are rapidly declining since then. And that is amid the largest childbearing population in the nation's history. So it's a collapse of fertility. It's a collapse of livability, of cost of living issues, since 2007, concurrent with zero interest rate policy, explosion of debt, little growth of GDP relative to the debt. It's created all sorts of problems that are plaguing young adults, and obviously they are making choices not to get married, not to have children, and the nation's future has flipped in a very short period. And when you look at census estimates from 2008 versus now, population growth has just collapsed.
Wow. And for folks that are listening on a podcast and can't look at the charts here, I mean, this is essentially what, about a 20% drop in births in just 13, 14 years? Yeah, 15 years maybe.
It's and I, when you look at what the census was anticipating, look at that later, but they were anticipating that births would be over 5 million annually right now. And instead we're at 3.6. So what they anticipated, that births would rise with the largest childbearing population. And obviously that economic factors would all be driven by that. And so the collapse in births, the collapse in the future size of the now the school-aged population, but soon the working-age population, has changed the economic direction of the nation.
Wow. All right. This chart's going to make it
This
hard for me to sleep tonight, Chris, just to
is
put you
well,
down.
it's, I think, to be able to have a productive discussion about where we're going, we have to know where we are.
Absolutely.
And so, whether it's not good, it's not bad, it's just, it is. And these, math is just is. But what we're looking at here, this is again the 25, 54-year-old employed population. So each time, so the reason you see it rising, that blue line rising until 1990, is it took a while for women to be fully into the labor force. By 1990, women were fully in the labor force, and ever since then, every peak has happened essentially about 80, 81% labor force participation. Once we get there, that's it. That's as far as the economy can grow. Beyond that, there is no more labor growth. People are mothers, people are caregivers. That remaining 20% just are not going to enter the job market, either incapable, unwilling, all sorts of other reasons. So as we look at that 90, 2000, 2007, 20, and again in 23, that's the peak. And each time it coincides with the black line, terminal federal funds rate. So when you have full employment, every time it coincides with the federal funds rate at its terminal rate. And then interest rate cuts are coming. Debt is about to explode. So the red line is going to go straight up. And since 2007, the green line, the Fed's balance sheet is going to go straight up because you've maxed out your potential growth. And once you stop growing, by definition, you're in recession. And all of the, if the same playbook is used, then debt explodes and interest rates
Okay.
go back to zero or very low.
All right. So yet another data series that says, hey, be wise to start preparing for a recession here and expect a commensurate explosion in debt spending.
That seems to be, yeah, that's the game plan every time.
All righty.
Just quickly here, this is the if you take the tw 24 months before and after peak employment. So what you see there, 81.9% in 2000, that is peak employment. You look at the 24 months prior, the 24 months after. And I call out each of these were peak employment moments. So in this cycle, July was our peak employment, and we're rolling over just like we've rolled over in every other recession. And for a slow, obviously the black line is you're looking at 2020, and so that was I don't anticipate we're going to see a line like that again.
Yeah,
I hope.
that's an embarrassing year. Hopefully we don't get another global pandemic that shuts the world
No.
economy down or a world war or something like that. Yeah.
Exactly. But so generally this looks a lot like 2000. It looks a lot like 2007, 1990, that we start to roll over. And then we just accelerate down. And that was the entire point of the Fed's interest rate hikes and the cost of debt rising to slow the economy. And so it was, this is not some sort of crazy idea. That was the intention.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that really gets me about the soft landing crowd is to believe that we're going to have a soft landing. And look, we might. I'm not saying we're not going to have one, but to really push all your chips onto the soft landing side of the table, you do have to believe it's going to be different this time.
Well,
Yeah,
and
history.
you have to, for me, there's no fuel. The fuel is a potential labor force that is unemployed, that is not already employed, or that you have high population growth. We have neither of those. We have full employment, given the numbers. I mean, we can debate whether or not that's a good thing or a bad thing right now, but we have full employment by the numbers, and we have very little population growth. So there's really no fuel for further growth. So to think that we're going to have a soft landing without any fuel in the tank, just it never has worked.
All right. Okay. So yeah, and another just sort of like, hey, no one knows exactly what the future is going to hold, but everybody should at least have a plan B that, okay, if a recession materializes over the next, 16 to 18, 6 to 18 months, do I have a plan for that?
That's what the data is suggesting. And again, I'm not selling anything here, so I'm not. I'm just simply showing the data, and I like. Hopefully, people can make their own minds up of what it means. But
Yeah,
this is a go ahead.
and sorry, but I should have mentioned this at the outset. Your website, and make sure I pronounce it correctly, Economica. Okay, it's a passion project of yours, meaning
Correct.
you have another job. You're not selling necessarily like a newsletter or a trading service or anything like that. You're doing this because you love data and you feel the data that you look at tells a really important story that you're trying to share with the world, but you're not, there's not a commercial element to it.
I'm a hobbyist. So this, you know, take all of this with a big grain of salt, but it's just, the data is what it is. And so here we're looking at annual U.S. births, annual U.S. deaths, and then census projections. So, you know, where you see the blue line, 1990, 4.2 million births, 2007, 4.3. So the census in 2000 and again in 2008 was anticipating, so we would be at 4.7 million births in 20. We were at 3.66. That delta between what they anticipated, what we're getting, is growing rapidly. Deaths, the red line, you can see obviously the pandemic, there was a spike. It's still higher than the census estimated it would be, significantly higher. There's questions about why and how that's, where that's going. But you can see that the census estimate for births now, the two dashed lines, there's a medium and a low, and then the estimate for deaths, that's the natural crossover point where we go from natural population growth to natural decline. And it's somewhere out there within 10 years that we move from natural population growth to natural decline, if their estimates are correct.
Okay. And this would be first time in U.S. history, right?
Correct.
Yeah. So just to underscore that again, you're saying we're 10 a decade-ish away from the point, unless something material changes, where our population is going to start shrinking nationally, where we're going to have more deaths than we have births.
Yeah. 10 to 15 years is like the window right now of using their data, the census data. The census has been terrible at forecasting. Every time they forecasted, they've been over forecasting births, and they've never been able to get down to reality. So I think we can guesstimate that it's going to be sooner. Births will continue to go down faster than they're anticipating.
All right.
The crossover point is coming, I think, within the decade, where we go to natural decline.
Great, right. And again, to our earlier point, if we want to fix this issue, if we want to have a growing working population, like, we don't have a lot of time to figure it out. It's going to take time to put whatever strategy we come up with in place. And if we're talking about 10-ish to 15 years before we start nosing over, better get our act together pretty quickly.
Yeah, exactly. And that one point that I think is important here is that this is all births on U.S. soil. This is not just U.S. This is anyone, everyone born. So this includes all of the immigrant births.
Yeah, yeah. It includes the immigrants. Yeah. Anybody born in a hospital, I think.
Whether they're here legally or illegally, when they are born here, they are American and they are in this number of declining births.
Yeah. All right. Sobering, and again, adds urgency to the situation.
And just a quick look. So this is the census data of what they're expecting, population growth decelerating. The red line is immigrants. The blue line is native born population. Just underscoring again, the only thing that's going to keep the nation from moving into depopulation is obviously either births spike, which they're not likely to, or immigration.
All right. And just so you know, Chris, you know, I have very slightly begun to really tackle the immigration topic on this channel. I have sort of committed to the audience that I'm actively out there looking to bring on guests to be able to talk about the whole situation in as nonpartisan, non-emotionally charged a way as we can. But your data is just making me realize I need to dial up the priority of that.
Well, that's great. That's one convert. this is overkill, but this is, again, these are actual births, red line. And then you've got all of the census estimates every 2000, 2008, 12, 14, 17, and then the 2023 estimate. So those are the dashed lines. So each time census lowers their estimate, and each time they cannot catch up to the birth rate falling, or the actual births falling even faster. They are now anticipating declining births, where 15 years ago they were expecting fast rising births. So the entire the framework that we're building on now is moving in a different direction.
Got it. And also, one, it maybe points to the fact that, you know, government projections aren't the best thing to trust, even in the best of times. But, you know, if this is the data that the current policymakers are basing their plans off of, clearly their plans are going to be inadequate because their estimates can't catch up to reality fast enough.
Yeah. And if we take the trend line is actually far steeper. And if when you look at Japan, when you look at China, when you look at most at Italy, at nation after nation, their actual projections are much rosier. The trend line is actually quite scary at how fast births are declining.
Okay. Well, again, thanks to guys like you that are just tracking the data as it is, so that you know, we're not just pinning our rosy hopes on government projections. We can actually see in front of us where the data is heading.
Yep. And I think we can skip this one. Sorry. I think we already covered this one. Oh, let's see. I think we covered that at the beginning.
Did we make it through? I'm at the end of the charts that you sent me.
There were some others, but I think that's a lot. Like, right. So,
well, let's see here. Did I miss some? Because I can pull them up, and let me just note this so I can cut this out. 449. How many other ones were there?
Ooh, I think there were like 20. 22.
Yeah. Which ones did I not get to here? Here is. There's a whole bunch here actually.
And I think they're probably on a different email. So I sort of
No. But I thought I downloaded all of these from the email. Bear with me one sec.
If we did it, that's great.
No, we didn't. You gave me a bunch that aren't showing up here, and I'm just trying to figure out. Let me just put them in the new ones in a different folder. Probably just be the fastest way to do it. Video editing.
I mean, I think my hope in all this is to get people discussing, and I like you said, I don't have the solutions here, but at least I think we know where we are to begin the discussion. And
look, these are phenomenal you know, conversation starters. Hopefully we're shaking some people out of their desire to just, you know, go back to sleep.
This is all obviously national. It's for me, it gets more interesting is when you look at, you know, internationally, and you look at what's happening, and because they are ahead of us on this slope, and like you said earlier, you know, how we're not learning from them is sort of incredible.
Yeah. Bear with me one second. I thought there were charts you sent here about the Wilshire 5000, and
let's see.
Where the hell is this? I just saw it earlier. No, maybe that is it. Maybe we did everything.
I'm just double checking. I think I didn't know how, you know, honestly, like that. I think that's I think that's it.
Okay.
That's all right. It. Sorry.
All right.
I was going through my email.
We'll wrap it up there. And there's, I mean, we'll hop back on and finish. But I mean, you do a lot of stuff around housing and housing inventory too, right?
Correct. Okay. Yeah. And I mean, we could throw that on there as well if you wanted. I mean, right now we're at record housing per capita and blowing out. I also do it by, I like to look at all of this like a weatherman. I mean, you're looking at highs and lows, and it just is.
Yep.
And, you know, you're not trying to sell snow or sell rain or whatever. It's and so when I look at I try and build repeatable ways to see things, whether it's housing per capita or
All right.
housing per household. And their housing per capita is at record.
This is great. I'm just going to interrupt you because I just say I want you to tell me this, but tell it to me on air so that, well, I want the audience to hear this too. So let's do the following here. I'll cut from when we went to this looking for slides and stuff. Let me get us back into the flow and then we'll wrap it up and I'll give you a chance to sort of say exactly whatever you want to say about your discipline. All right, here we go. 3, 2, 1. All right. Well, look, we're going to end it there. There's so many charts that you put together at your website, Chris, that I'd love to get to at some point. Not enough time to go into it in this conversation, but you're welcome to come back in the program at any time you like. But I would love to have you back, in particular, to dive into your housing charts,
Sure.
just as all the data that you took us through on just the demographic side of things. I know you get a bunch on the housing market, and again, some of them kind of go against a lot of the prevailing narratives, like, oh, we have an inventory problem. I know you've got some charts that speak against that in certain ways. So as we begin to wrap up here, I guess first and foremost, for folks that have really enjoyed this conversation and would like to follow you and your work from here, where should they go?
I mean, I'm primarily on Twitter. Once upon a time, I used to be very busy on my blog, but to this point, I've just been tweeting snarky, hopefully not less and less snarky stuff, and trying to just put out some interesting information and start some conversations.
All right, and you were telling me off camera that just kind of your approach to all this, and I think it'd be instructive for folks to hear about it. Where, I said earlier that this is sort of a passion project for you. You're not doing it to sell anything, but you really tend to try to approach all this data in as agnostic and as empirical a way as possible, at least as I understand it. But can you just describe your approach for folks?
Yeah, and I think, like we were talking about off camera, it was just that whether it's the meteorological sort of approach or whether it's this is like a project for NASA, and you just want to understand all the inputs and then understand all of the potential dials and so that you can manage that craft. And I try and look at the economy that way of what are the inputs, what do they do, how do they, what are the impacts of dialing them up or down, and so. I'm just trying to build a framework to understand what's happening and where that moves. I don't have a vested interest in selling anything or in the economy going a certain way. I just want a discussion to be had about where we are. First, we have to know where we are, and then we can discuss where do we want to go? And is this the right path? Is this is maybe potentially harming the younger generation to serve the elder generation? Is that the correct approach? Is that what we want? Is that the legacy? And I think, but we have to have the data in front of us to be able to have that discussion.
All right. Well, thank you for being one of those people who goes forth, gets the data, and then packages it in a way that the rest of us can clearly see what's going on. Like you, I'm a huge proponent of the informed discussion, and I'm an even bigger proponent of informed decision making. And you can't do that without the informed part, without the information. So thank you so much for helping surface the information for all of us. I've got one last question for you that I'm going to ask in just a second. I know that you're a parent as well, and we've been talking a lot about demographics here, but certainly in the context of the economy, I've been asking a lot of my recent guests here for any insight they might want to offer in terms of like a non-monetary investment that they would encourage people to consider adding in their life. I'm sure you give lots of life advice to your kids, so you got about 30 seconds to think about your answer for that. While you're doing that, just a couple quick housekeeping notes. One, just want to remind folks that the Thoughtful Money Spring Conference is still planned for Saturday, March 16th. Ticket sales have actually been really good for that. A lot of people are taking me up on my advice to register now so that you can lock in that lowest early bird price discount. That discount's still around. And a reminder, if you're a premium subscriber to our Substack, you get an additional $50 off of that low early bird price. And even if you're not a current subscriber, to the Substack. You could become one right now. It only costs 15 bucks a month. I don't mind at all if you pay the 15 bucks to save the greater 50 bucks and just, you know, use it as an arbitrage. Great. I want you to get the lowest price for the conference that you can get. Secondly, as Chris's charts showed us, you know, we are in a very different, we're entering a very different future from what virtually everybody watching this video has lived up until now. These are some just seismic shifts in what's happening with the global economy based on just the demographics alone. How are we going to navigate that? What implications is that going to have for the economy, for wealth building? And how do you build a portfolio that can navigate through all that? I just want to underscore for folks, it's terra incognita for a lot of people, including a lot of the financial advisors. So I highly recommend that almost everybody watching this, unless you're highly skilled yourself, you work with a good financial advisor to develop a plan for this type of future, but obviously work with one that understands and appreciates all the data that Chris just went through here. If you've got one who can do that well for you, great, stick with them. But if you don't, or you'd like a second opinion from one who does, consider getting a free consultation with one of the financial advisors that Thoughtful Money endorses. To do that, just go to thoughtfulmoney.com, fill out the short form there. These consultations are totally free. There's no commitment to work with these advisors. It's just a free public service they offer, and more important than ever, based upon Chris's charts. All right, Chris, now we're here for you. What's a non-money related investment that you think would benefit folks to consider?
I mean, for one, my kids give me most of my advice. They're at the age now that they're smarter than I am. And so it's, you know, the non-monetary is remember how important every day is, and remember that sky's blue. Life goes on, and that we will manage our way through it. And whatever is coming, it's not the end. It's just the beginning of something else. And so keep that in mind. Don't get doomsday-ish or down about demographics or other issues. We will resolve them. We've resolved so many issues before, wars, other things. Hopefully we'll resolve this as well.
That's a great point. And, you know, I've been talking about this a lot recently. I mean, if you go back more than just a generation or two, like, life was pretty hard for folks. I mean, if you grew up in the Greatest Generation and had to go fight World War I and then again, you know, go into World War II, if you lived back in the 1800s and had to, you know, work in these factories where there were no, you know, safety precautions, if you had to be a subsistence farmer, the century, like life was really hard, but people still made do and they still enjoyed their lives. And as you said, the sun still shone and the sky was still blue. There's a lot of fear about change, right? And if the change is forced on you, yeah, it doesn't feel great necessarily, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the future has to be worse from maybe from a standard of living. Yeah, maybe it could get knocked down a few pegs. It doesn't mean your quality of life has to be knocked down a few pegs.
Correct. Yeah.
Talked a lot about the way in which people find happiness and meaning in life and whatnot. And very little of it is actually driven by money. So I very much appreciate your point there. All right. Well, look, folks, if you've enjoyed having Chris on this program, really valued his charts, would like to see him come back on in the future to walk through some more of the charts he has. And like I said, I'd love to see another version of this diving deep into his housing data. Please let Chris know that by hitting the like button and then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. Chris, we went long here. Thanks so much for putting the prep in, for getting all these charts prepared. Thanks for hanging with me, getting through them all in this discussion. Really appreciate all your time. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.
Thanks.